So thank you very much. I listened to Ariel. I realized I'm really here to scare you. I'm going to talk. I gave this title originally, but I think what I really should have said, I wanted to talk about the astrophysics of type 1a supernova cosmology. It turns out, if you want to do cosmology with type 1a's, you have to understand what's going on in terms of astrophysics, what the source is, what the supernovae are, that's what you like on. What's happening on the way, that's what other people call foregrounds. Ariel talked quite a bit about this. I will be rather short on that. And then the last thing, which Ariel only touched very briefly on, is how is our position in the universe to actually measure the universe itself? And so those are things that I want to talk about. This may be too much for an hour, but we'll see how far we get. I just wanted to start off where Ariel sort of left off. This is the most recent data sets that we have. Unlike the CMB people, we do actually show every single object. So occasionally we bin, but normally we do not bin. You see three data sets in here. You see a local data set. Another difference, I should say, I always plot the redshift in a logarithmic scale, so I get nice straight lines. This is, I guess I'm sort of grandchild of Alan Sandage in some level. So I plot the logarithm here for the redshift. So you have a local sample, and then you have, at the moment, two distant samples. We heard the SNLS, SDESS2 will fill in here. So the black lines are the ESSENCE 3-year data, and the blue dots are the SNLS 1st-year data. And you see that SNLS is 3 times as much as we do, essentially, okay? And that's exactly the numbers. That's how they should work out. That's fine. This is the contour, if you want, the omega lambda, omega matter. That's just the combined data set of everything together, only the supernovae. These are these two distant surveys. They are, at the moment, the most interesting one. I believe that both of them will finish next year. So SNLS will finish next year. As I said, the first year data was 71 supernovae. They're now at almost 300. But what I want to point out is there's a lot of interesting other stuff coming out that's very interesting for the supernova history itself. So there's a whole set of papers coming out of that collaboration, and a whole set of papers that came out of the ESSENCE, and I'll talk about these very briefly. Just to get this out of the way, the bottom line here is here's the equation of state parameter, W minus 1.02, plus minus 0.09, plus minus 0.05. This is the SNLS first year data. This is the ESSENCE 3-year data. We get essentially the same thing. We have a large systematic error because we treat the systematics differently from the SNLS. So there's a little bit of how do I express this correctly? You can be more or less conservative what you assume about your systematics. Let me put it that way. I don't want to be too strong about this. So that's sort of based on something like almost 200 supernovae. This is the table that you have to put into a paper these days. This is taken out of the Wood-Vassy paper. And if you look, this is the systematics table. So you have systematics in here. This is the delta W that they contribute, 0.04, 0.08, 0.06. Now, that's the systematics that you almost cannot get away with, okay? And it's what I said before. It's, strangely enough, your photometric system, how well can you calibrate how much light you actually get from your object from the sky? And it has to do with the atmosphere we're living in. You think that's a solved problem. Well, it turns out it's like many of these things. It's slightly chaotic. It's changing all the time, so you have to calibrate that out, and that's not fully done in all cases. Even if you stick to a single telescope, you have that problem. The extinction, the absorption, I'll talk about this very briefly. The intrinsic color of type 1a supernovae, it turns out these two things are connected, and so it's very, very difficult to get those separated. So,
So the last thing is what sometimes is referred to as the Hubble bubble. I have some more to say. And Ariel talked about this as well. I think this is now the most complete data set that Anne Marie's just put out. It took together these three data sets, or includes those three
data sets, plus an extra 23 supernovae and redshifts larger than one, and a large nearby supernova sample. Okay? So that's the 180 objects. And that's the Hubble diagram that Adam shows. You can read all sorts of things in here. I think one of the most important results out of this is that if you can, you actually now can measure the Hubble parameter, okay, as a function of redshift. So you can actually see how the expansion rate of the universe is changing as a function of redshift. This is something that theorists have been asking from us for years and years, and this is the first time that this is actually done. Okay. So that's quite a good, it's an important measurement, I think. Good, I'll skip that. This is just to drive home another point that Ariel has been making. It's becoming very difficult. So here again is the supernova data set. Now you bin it together, and so these are the bin points. You get that together, and this is now plotted against a whole slew of different models, away from what you may call the standard cosmological model. So up here you have standard cases, you have a flat lambda, you have a regular general lambda W, WA, a time variable W, then you have Chaplygin gas and various others. So here's the DGP model, and you see that these various models up here, they're just don't make any difference to the distribution. So if you now want to use the supernovae to distinguish between any of these models up here, you're in big trouble, okay? Because you just have no power to do this. And Ariel showed this. This is if you take a flat lambda CDM. So that's the simplest thing you can do. W is minus one. Yes?
DGP model in a retrofitted
yes. This is very low. I have to say I'm not. I don't know what's going on here. I guess I do. I'll show this in a moment. There is some tension. I actually, to be honest, I don't know exactly what went into this model. So this is, as I said, the simplest model you can do. The flat lambda CDM, and you have these combinations of the
likelihoods of the supernovae, the CMB, and the baryonic acoustic oscillations. There's a wonderful concordance. Everything comes together at the same place. That's the simplest model you can look at. If you then allow a time variable lambda, that's what you get. That's and you see it's not only the supernovae that blow up, but essentially all your methods just blow up. Okay, that's another illustration of what Arya said before. The data cannot support this. Okay? Even if this is the true model of the universe, we cannot measure it. Not with the data sets that we have right now, okay? That's just an important point to make, and as Ariel said, some people find the solution. You have to be honest with your error bars, that's what you get. And so here's the DGP model, and you see this tension of the supernovae with these other data sets. Ariel showed this already. So depending on what you, how you parameterize this, I guess maybe you have different solutions. It's not that this is excluded at the moment, but it's certainly not a good thing. And then you have something like a Chaplygin gas where you see that the data sets just don't overlap. And this may be the only model at the moment that can be excluded with the current data set. So that's what I said before. This is the astrophysics I want to do. Understand your source, understand what affects the light on its path, and then know your local environment. So here is a source, this supernova. Turns out this is not even a supernova we like. Well, some of us like it, but it's not for cosmology. This is the SDSS2 data set. This is just a tiny fraction of what's actually available there. We heard, 200, 300 available right now? 400, I'm sorry. Okay, so 421, so this is just a subset. Just to illustrate a little bit, there's a little white dot. Sometimes it's red, okay, sometimes it's not, it's even littler, it's smaller than you think. So those are the supernovae. And you have to do these individually. This is not something that you get in one shot. You have to do each one at a time, and you have to follow it through and do a lot of work. And this is when it gets to HST. These are the most distant ones, distant 1As we've observed. Of course, you don't see them, they're too big. Okay. Again, let's talk about the systematics. There are things, this is following up on Ariel. You have to worry about contamination. You have to worry about the fact that you actually do observe a type 1A supernova, not a gamma ray burst or a type 2 supernova, God knows what. So not everything that's variable in the sky and looks to be close to another galaxy is a type 1A supernova. So you have to make sure that you sort this out. You have to do correct photometry. You have to do the K corrections. Essentially, you have to translate into the rest frame from the observer frame into the rest frame. Now, that's a trivial thing, you think. But if you don't know the spectrum well enough, well, you introduce an extra problem, an extra error, and maybe even systematics. Malmquist bias. There is this normalization with the light curve shape parameter that actually you didn't talk very much about this, and I won't talk about this much either. But that's a problem too. This is the degree to which supernovae are not standard candles. Okay, and I'm going to be a little brutal on that. There is this question about evolution. How do you make sure that your local object is the same? Sorry, your distant object is the same as the local object. The reddening, absorption, and then the local expansion field. And so I think this is what I said again. So this is just measurement. So you have to work harder and harder to sort this out. This is your source. Understand your source. This is the path, and this is the local environment. Okay. I just wanted to. This list here is coming from. I actually worked together with some other people in Europe on a report, which is called Fundamental Cosmology. Where does it say? So it should say Fundamental Cosmology up here. This happened to be almost the same time scale as the Dark Energy Task Force. So we did this in Europe. John Peacock and Peter Schneider were the lead people on that. And I happened to write the supernova section. And the list from before was the list that I had. And I'm some of you may know me. I'm a rather critical person about the whole supernova business. So I had this list put down and said, this is really hard. And then John Peacock, editing the report, said, well, the length of the list indicates, the list of these systematics, indicates the maturity of the field, and it is the result of more than a decade of careful study. And that's what Ariel said as well. So we've sometimes I feel it's very easy to criticize us, and we should be criticized. I have no problem with that. But I see other people getting up and say, we have a clean measurement to do all these things, and they're not quite honest, okay? Weak lensing will have its own problems in one form or another. So it's true we have problems, but it's also true that, as Ariel said, we're working on them. Okay, so what are these type 1A supernovae? And this is going to be a long section here. They're really complicated. Well, God, would we wish they would be like the CMB, okay? But they're not. And they're terrible light bulbs. But given that, they're also fantastic physical objects. I think they're brilliant things. Well, they are brilliant things, but there's also brilliant physics involved with them. There's a whole history or story about generator systems, which I will actually skip. So, but for the cosmology, the most important bit is we actually want to know the global parameters. That's the important bit. Because I will move away, and I will say this very, very strongly, I will move away from the standard candle picture. Sometimes this is somewhat of a semantics, but let's be clear here. They're not 60-watt bulbs, okay? They're ranging in luminosity by a factor of 10 at least, okay? So standard candle, standardizable. They're excellent distance indicators. You'll hear me say this more often, but they're not standard candles. Okay, this is a personal gripe I have with everybody else, but that's what it is. So you want to know what the fuel is. Okay, the fuel turns out is nuclear synthesis, is nuclear synthesized, newly produced nickel. That nickel then drives the luminosity, but as a matter of fact, it turns out you also have to know where it sits in the ejecta. If you have nickel concentrated to the center, you deposit the gamma rays in a different, well, same way, but more efficiently than if you have it distributed way out, for example. The total mass, this is sort of a sacrilege to even talk about this. Of course, there's Chandrasekhar mass white dwarfs. Well, I'll show you about this. And then the explosion energies is something we need to know. So here's the issue on the contamination. I don't want to go through all this. All I want to say is this is the type 1As. This is what you want to look at. And you have to separate them out from all these other variable objects out there. This is the distribution of light curves. This is taken from Nathan Smith's paper. These are the only type 1As in here. I can't even find them. Here is the type 1A, the black one. OK, so that's the type 1A. The others are all type 2s or type 1Bs and whatever. You don't know. So now, it turns out if you have a diagram like this and then you give it to physics today, they make these into possible 2As, which is something I actually had never heard of before. So I don't know what they talk about. Well, I know what they talk about, but what I want to say here is this is whole zoo of nomenclature, which has no physics in it at all, almost no physics. But the 1As, this here, this section here, is what we really need to know. Okay? Distance indicators, that's what it says here. This is the simplest test that I know just to tell you that we can measure relative distances, not absolute distances, but relative distances for with these supernovae. You take a Hubble diagram, again, in this case, this is the recession velocity. This is a nearby sample. You plot the distance modulus, the distance. You measure the distance. You plot this up. There's a line in here which is actually given by the fact that the universe is expanding linearly. Okay? The slope of this line up here is not a free parameter unless you give up on anisotropy and homogeneity. That line has to be fixed at that slope. And you look at the scatter, and you see that the scatter is of the order of something like 20%, maybe. Okay. And that gives you an indication of how good a distance indicator these objects are.
I come back to that later.
The reason that the scatter is so much bigger at small velocities is about motion.
Yes. So back here, once you go below 3,000, you have curie velocities, and the recession velocity doesn't tell you anything. It's not half as large. So that region that gets you into the Virgo cluster. So this is also typically people exclude everything below 3,000 and sometimes below 5,000. Okay? So here's the standard model of type 1A supernovae. You have the Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf. You have densities at core of 10 to the 10 grams per centimeter. You have a few tens to 10 to 9 Kelvin. And once you get that in a carbon oxygen, degenerate carbon oxygen core, you can actually burn carbon oxygen explosively and burn it all the way to nucleus cystic equilibrium. So you get a higher core. Now, there's a lot of physics in here that I will only talk about very briefly. This is taken from a paper that actually just appeared by Fritz Rapke. So what they do, they take the inner core and they seed explosion points. And let that blow up. That. And goes into the brain very quickly, mushrooms, brains, whatever. And you see the scale, it blows up very, very quickly. But you also see this is not the spherical symmetric explosion that we used to love. Once you go to 3D, you get very complicated structures that, in this case, also have to do with the fact that you have many explosion points. Now, you can also go in and just have a single explosion point. You still create structure, not as strong as this, but still create structure due to instabilities.
What are the initial conditions for that?
Yes, so what was the story behind this explosion seeds?
I think you can show the movie again.
Right, I can show you the movie again.
But from the initial conditions, I wouldn't bother that it's not starting as well.
That's what I expect.
Yes. But what people, there's one thing that people never talk about. The white dwarf, before it explodes, starts carbon oxygen burning about 1,000 years
It's simmering. It's sitting there and it's simmering before it actually has a runaway. Okay. Now during that simmering phase, which nobody has modeled, that you can expect, and that's what they assume here, that you sort of stochastically have a distribution where you start the ignition. Okay. And so that's the reason why they have these blobs. As I said, if you have a single explosion sent a point, okay, then you get similar structures to this as well, because you have a heavy fuel sitting above light ash, and so you get all sorts of instabilities.
So there are modeling explosion centers within the...
Yeah, so let me show you the next.
How is that distribution determined? Like, why is it that and not?
Oh, this is purely statistical. So there's some. They take what they do nowadays, at least this group. They take various different distributions. They run explosions with cyclic explosion points as well. It's just the movie that I have here has this distribution. And the reason they do this now is because you get different explosion energies. Can imagine that if you start with more explosion points, you get a stronger explosion. Now, whether this is true or not, that's an open question. This is, unfortunately, there's almost no way that we observers can get back to these theorists and tell them what they really actually
have. But the bottom line is, I mean, the fact that you use such a model tells us that there's still no model out for self-consistency.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, just to make this clear, we're not using any of this for cosmology. Okay. None of this goes into the cosmology problem.
Why are all the explosions the same size? That seems to be just simplification.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't be really.
No.
Well, on the inside, they're sort of lumped together. Right?
Yes. It's just a dense distribution. So here's another case. This is a different one where they have over 200 of these explosions. And again, they're sort of distributed within a certain volume. And that's just to show you how this goes. So this is within the white dwarf. That's now 0 seconds. After half a second, you have these fronts developing. And after about 3 seconds, you explode the star. Okay, so the explosion has now reached the surface of the star at full time. And that was about 10 seconds. There's a little movie here. I don't know whether I should, how much I want to show here, but this is now, it's just rotating the star after 10 seconds. Okay, so the explosion has been run for 10 seconds. It's rotating, and the color coding is carbon and oxygen is blue, magnesium is green, and so you see that there are certain sections where magnesium has come to the surface, and then the nickel, which is the fuel source, is red, and there's essentially no nickel. So what Fritz has done here is now cut it open. Okay, so now you see the inside, and what you want to see here is, so there is the nickel, which is red, it's distributed not in a shell or in a core, but it's distributed in a three-dimensional way, and you have oxygen mixed all the way in, very far. So this is just where we stand with the models. The reason I bring this up is just, as I said, we would like to understand the supernovae, and if we don't understand this, then it's very difficult.
Sorry, so just a question again. Is that faint picture you showed, is that empirically guided or theoretically motivated?
Empirically guided. So they want to run what they call self-consistent explosions. So they put in explosion centers, but then they let it go and calculate the fuel and the energy.
So that's the answer you get after.
Right.
So, sorry for slowing you down, just a stupid question. So what's the main problem in getting this thing self-consistently set up? Is it like because it's 3D viscous hydro?
It's 3D, well, it's the initial conditions. You don't know the initial conditions. The fact that you can't, well, I'm told, okay, that you have to model these, well, so there's initial conditions, you don't know where the white dwarf comes from, okay, at the simmering phase for 1,000 years, which you need to calculate. And the other thing is, the flame of, the burning flame is about a millimeter thick, I'm told, and you have to model this in this complicated structure for the whole, essentially for the whole star.
Also, it's a resolution problem.
It's a resolution problem. Oh, right. So this is the 10 seconds. Then you go to this very much gradient of the hydrodynamics. You have to get the light. Okay. So I do the photon escape. That's a whole other problem. Okay. That's a whole additional problem to the supernova explosion. Just to make that clear. Okay. So the calculations stop after 10 seconds, but I can confirm the stars. Yeah. I showed you this anyway that I was putting, but it's very similar to what Ariel showed. So here's the supernova, here's the two light curves. There's a blue light curve, there's a red light curve, it's just blue and red light. You see that the peak is different. Okay, so you have to be careful how you measure your peak for the cosmology. And you see that this beautiful, simple structure in the blue light curve is broken in the red and infrared, which tells you that there's some exophysics going on. Now, and Dan Kazin has now been able to essentially model these things. So these are filter light curves, ultraviolet, being blue, visual red, and then it goes into the genes here, A, I, J, H, K, and that's here of red. And he doesn't fit the data completely, but he's doing, let me tell you, he's doing much better than anybody else before. So he's getting a good handle on what may be going on. Supernova. Here is a spectral evolution. He's just plotted here the two bands, the B and the B band, which are the ones used most often. And you see the spectral evolution. Red is at day zero, at maximum, and then it goes down to blue, which is 20 days later. So these objects evolve very, very quickly. And depending at which moment you observe it in here, you get a different picture. So that's an advantage. It's this kind of result. Right? You get plots like this. This is coming out of Stockholm.
So do you normally do k-correct and spend the correction forward the stretch chain or along with the other?
They start done everything together. Stretch, okay. K-correct, and color.
So it includes, in effect, the spectrum.
Yeah, but you need to know which. Let me show you the this thing here. You need to know which of these spectral series, right? Okay. So it's not lack of data that we have. This is all nearby ones. This is coming out from CFA, and we have dozens of spectral series, but they're all subtly different. That's affecting your pain.
May I ask another question? If we look on these spectra, I mean, you have some dips which seem to be universal and others which do not match at all. Is there an idea why that is like that? Or?
Yes and no. There's a whole the spectrum modeling, as I didn't say, but it's very complicated. It's the Moiré spectrum in general are fairly uniform, but there are these significant differences. I agree.
Bruno, these are not all Moiré, right? These are
maybe the last picture because it was just bigger.
I thought
they
were
Moiré.
Are they not all Moiré? I thought they were. Well, maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Wait. Well, so nevertheless, okay. So they're not standard counts if I. There are large variations in the light curve shapes. I have to show you this. I have to show you the colors. But there's a large variation in spectral evolution. I'll show you the polarimetry. Okay, that's a critical thing. What I will do, I will ask this question: what is a type 1a supernova? Okay, this is a little tricky, but we now have many what is typically called peculiar objects. Whenever you have peculiar objects, your chances is you don't know what to do. And one of the elliptical problems is some of the objects in elliptical galaxies are peculiar type rays. So even if you restrict yourself to the ellipticals alone, you may have that problem. And I'll show you a little bit about the Michaelmas and Jekyllmas. This is a heresy. So the diversity of supernovae, we now name these objects in various ways. Here is 2000 CEX, 2002 CX, here is the likelihood of this thing. The reason I put this up is just to say this is not an issue that has that's related to data. We have enough data to see these things. Okay. And here's the comparison. So this is 2002 CX. This is the B band, the RMI, and you see that these are all the solid curves are very, very well measured supernovae, and you see there are strong differences. And as what's in the infrared, you have cases where the stick, which shows up in most all supernovae, some supernovae is not shown. Okay, so there's clearly strong variations. Here, look at this case. This is a new case. The light curve is this wide light curve. Has nothing to do with the more regular light curve. This is a case that's extremely slow.
Andy Howell put from the legacy survey, supernova legacy survey, put this out. This may be a case where they believe that this is actually a super Chandrasekhar explosion. So the inferred mass in this object, it's so luminous and it's so slowly evolving that the inferred mass is actually more than 1.4 solar mass.
How was that again? You trap more gamma rays. You trap more gamma rays, and so you convert more of that gamma rays into the optical flux. That's what it is.
So statistically, I mean, how informed are you to Courier examples compared to the whole data period?
There's very little being done in that respect. It's about a third. A paper that's fairly old says it's about a third of the options of the period. Is that right?
But most of them are faint ones, which you would never capture anyway.
Some of them are faint, some of them are bright.
I mean, the guy like the one there, it's 100, and it's like 50 centimeters away from the Hubble diameter. You would never mix this guy up. Just so up.
But that's picking it.
We'll say that's for
gold. Yeah. But 50 sigmas, I think, is not only rough.
But then you wonder, isn't the same thing happening?
That's right. And the other question is, this one may be 50 sigmas away. The other one is 5 sigmas away. Okay. You don't know whether this is a question I'm going to address in a moment. You know, if this is a different beast, if this is a different explosion, and we can recognize it as a different explosion, right, no problem. But if this is just the outlier in the bell curve, how do you know? And so that's, Ariel said this many times, you want to work this out as a nearby cell, but you don't fix that with this cell.
Is there a measure for the statistical measure for the year?
SDSS2 will be the survey to do this. Okay? The nearby data set, the very nearby data set is too diverse to really be an honest statistical sample. The distant data sets are too sparse. That we can really do this honestly. And as Ariel already pointed out, we lose the faithful. So SDSS2 is, in my opinion, is the place to do this, right? So that's what we think. Polarimetry, very brief. This is the spectrum of type 1A, silicon-wise, salt-wise, etc., oxygen, gaseous. And you see, here is the polarization. These are linear polarizations. You see, here's the polarization signal, and you see that in the line of silicon, there is strong polarization, there's some indication that there may be some other line polarized, but continuous essentially non-polarized. Now, that's good news. The continuum is non-polarized means that at least the continuum is probably close to spherical. But the bad news is that since you have these in the lines, that means there's something like you may have clumps of material that's sort of floating around. This is a lot unlike the picture I showed before from the explosion model. Well, so that's one thing. But then here's another case. So again, this is spectral evolution. And here is the polarimetry. Here is a case, here are two cases, which is the scary bit. So these are two supernovae, two type 1As, at maximum light. One has a very strongly polarized calcium light, out here, but has essentially no polarization silicon, whereas this one has a very strongly polarized silicon line and a much weaker calcium. So what you're seeing here are 3D effects. You do see now 3D effects in the supernova, I think, line of sight effects, which, again, makes you worry. So that's what I guess that's a summary. There is very little in the continuum, which makes those very rough, excellent. But there is partially strong line polarization. So you see the clumping of the individual elements, and that may point to an inhomogeneous explosion mechanism, which is a problem. It may mean that you have tendencies of viewing angles, which I believe is trouble. And it's been pointed out that some of the polarization may actually correlate with the electrical element, like the chain or the luminosity. So what is a type 1a supernova? Here's a whole set of peculiar cases. There's yesterday was another one that's like this one, so another supergiant Sagar. I didn't dwell on this at the beginning, but of course we all know type 1a supernovae are the ones without hydrogen. That's by definition. You look at this guy here, it has extremely strong hydrogen emission, so it seems to be a type 1a. Okay? Well, you're starting to get into trouble and things like that. The great thing is you move away from counting leaves to do real physics.
So am I able to classify this as a
type 1a? Because the luminosity, the light curve, and the other features, all other features, if you look at this here, are matching up with a 1A.
So the
hydrogen
definition is not an exclusion.
Well, what people think here is, what you see is that this is a type 1A that exploded within a hydrogen pool. And so you see a secondary effect. Now, there are papers out there that do the same. Use this exact same data to play as a type of CC. So anyhow, that's one thing. So here's the light curve that I said. You use the light curve and it comes like out of 1A. Here is the Super Chandra object from Andy Hamill.
Again, what they like to point out here is that unfortunately this is a redshift 0.2 supernova, so their signal isn't great. But the lines in here are much narrower than what you see for regular type 1A. And that's the reason they think it's a super Chandra. This is another set. So essentially, there's a whole group. Well, there's several groups, unfortunately, that are out there that we don't actually, we think they're 1As, but actually we don't know what the physics is that's going on. So I said this already, there's a large variation up to a factor of 10 in the luminosity. I'll show you some more. And what I had a little program with students to go out and try to measure the total mass from observations. So rather than say it's Chandrasekhar mass, try to measure that in some funny way, look at the distribution of the nickel, and maybe look at the explosion energies. You all know this. This is the power source. You create nickel 56. You have gamma rays decaying into cobalt 56, and then the cobalt decays again with gamma rays and the positron channel into iron 56 that's missing. Okay? And you could do something very simple. You can take the nickel decay decay, that's this here. You can take the cobalt decay, that's this, and then you have a double decay, so that's the red line. So that's the energy input that you get. You take a ball of nickel, and you can calculate exactly how much energy you put into the supernova. That's this line here. We've shown here an observed light curve. So in the beginning, you don't get all the light out. It's optically thick. At some point, it comes all out, and then it decays. And this here, the difference here says that you're losing the gamma rays. So the ejector isn't big enough, isn't thick enough to capture all the gamma rays. So you have the gamma rays leak out, and you only convert some of the gamma rays into the emission. Okay, so you can do this. This is very straightforward. And then there's something called Arnett's rule. Dave Arnett sort of postulated that at near the maximum or at maximum, the emerging light, the emerging energy, is the same as what's put in at the same moment, okay? Here are the light curves that we put together, so that's the factor of 10. And then you can go out and do this for different objects, and you can calculate the nickel mass in each of those, okay? So you can try to fit these light curves with a trivial model, as a matter of fact. And here's the distribution of the nickel masses. They go from one solar mass down to a tenth of a solar mass. That's your standard candle, okay? This is like every time you go and fill up your car, you get a different engine, kind of, okay? I wanted to show you something about the Hubble constant. So in principle, you could do the Hubble constant. Here's Hubble's law. Here's the luminosity distance. Here's the double decay. That's the energy that you get out of the nickel if you put in a certain amount of nickel, okay? It's trivial to calculate, and then you can couple this all together, and you get an equation that has the Hubble constant on one side. It has the recession velocity, or the redshift here in the end. It has some form factors. I'll talk about this. It has a flux, and it has the nickel mass. Okay. So I'm very proud of this equation because I can equate the Hubble constant with the nickel mass in these type 1As. So how do I do this? Okay, well, so the first step is Hubble's law, okay? The second step is I plug in the luminosity distance. So for the distance here, I put in this square root. The third thing is Arnett's rule. So that's now making use of the fact that at peak luminosity, at the peak here, at peak luminosity, this is proportional to the nickel energy that's coming out, okay? Now, I put in a fudge factor because Arnett's rule is only a rule, it's not a law. So we have a free parameter in here, to just fudge this uncertainty that we don't know how accurate this is. And then back here, I plug in the nickel cobalt nickel decay time, which of course I said depends on the nickel mass, okay? And I get this. Now I get this extra curve here, function here, which has to do with the rise time. I have to connect the time when the nickel starts decaying, the time of explosion, to the time when I'm observing maximum, okay? And that time difference is so I have to connect these two times, and that gives me another uncertainty in here, okay, that plugs through to the Hubble constant. But I'm in a situation when I measure the flux, and I measure the redshift, and you know, my kind friends of modelers give me the nickel mass, I can actually tell you the Hubble constant. I need one single object to do this. Okay, well, so here's the problem. They're not standard candles. If they're standard candles, we'd be done. If they're all the same, we would be done. But they're not. And so what I have to do here, these are, I forget, 5 or 6 supernovae, but I don't know the nickel mass that's in that explosion, unfortunately. Okay, so I don't know the nickel mass, and so I can now plot for assumed nickel masses and the observed parameters, I can plot what Hubble constant I would get. Okay? So each supernova gives me a point at every input mass, okay, and it goes with 1 over the square root of the nickel mass. So that's this. And so now I would like to determine a Hubble constant. Well, so these guys I throw away. These are my peculiar objects, okay? these are peculiar. The other thing, I could start here at 1.4 solar masses. If the general sector masses are the masses of the white dwarfs, well, I cannot have anything above here, okay? But truly, I can only have, there's no model anywhere out there that gives me anything like 1 solar mass of nickel, okay? 1.4 solar mass of nickel would mean you've burned the whole star into nickel, which is, we know, you know, you see oxygen, you see these other elements. So this is like an upper limit. So I take now my strongest explosion and plug it in with my weakest observed object. Okay. So I know I'm doing only an estimation. And I come out with a Hubble constant of 50. Okay. So if you want to make type 1A supernovae out of white dwarfs, you're bound to have a Hubble constant that's bigger than 50. There's no way you can do that below. And most likely, you see that, you know, a Hubble constant of 70, which is measured by other methods, comes in quite nicely. That actually would fit fine. So here are three models. Sorry, two models and my one solar mass. This is an old model from the Max Planck group. This is the famous W7 model that's been used for several decades now. And here's my range of my faintest supernova. And you see I come in at, well, if I do this, I came in at 50. I have, if I plug in some of these things, I come in at higher Hubble constants. You can turn this around. You can turn this around and you can say, well, if the Hubble constant is 70, I can actually predict how much nickel those guys have to produce. And so that's one of the, my only way to tell those guys what they have to do.
That's a super cool result because it rules out all this rubbish about having no dark energy.
Absolutely.
For that, you would really need a lot of
I did this because Sudhir Sarkar was complaining about, talking about Hubble constants of 40 and 30. And that's what poison for all.
This is great. Can't you go up to 1.4 again?
Well, if you go to 1.4 solar mass, it's where the whole white dwarf is nickel.
Yeah, can't you do that?
Well, yes, you could, but I suspect you wouldn't see the supernova.
Okay. The fact that it's an entity is a peculiar one.
It's a peculiar one, too, yeah. I know, I'm sorry. I should change that. I've got one step further, and I have to rush here a little bit.
I've got one step further. If I know how many nickel atoms, nuclei I have here at the peak, I know exactly how many gamma rays I produce back here. Okay. And I can calculate the gamma ray escape. And the gamma ray escape goes with the ejector mass. So essentially it goes with the column density sitting on top of my nickel. So I can now construct an equation where I have form factors, I have something that goes with the velocity, that's my column density, how fast my ejector expands. I have a capacity here, and I have a form factor to sort of talk about the distribution of the nickel within the ejector. And I can fit my observed light curve here with different curves, which essentially come down to a combination of these three parameters. Okay, so I can try to measure now the nickel total mass of the supernova. And that's done here. Again, that's been done with Max Fritzing, a student of mine. Here is 1.4 solar masses up here. Okay? So that's the canonical type 1a progenitor. And down here, sorry. That's right, the ejector mass, and here's the nickel mass. So you have to be above this line. You have, you know, the ejector has to be more than the nickel you produce. But you see first of all, you see the scatter, and you see that not a single one of our points reaches 1.4 solar masses. This is a happily ignored result by the community because they claim that we have various things not under control, which may be true. Maybe the physics is too simple, but it would be nice to understand this better. Okay. Where are we going? So we have different. We still haven't resolved which of these mechanisms. Subsonic or supersonic explosions are actually at work. We have seen that there are three-dimensional structures. There's another component here, which is high-velocity material observed. We have different expansion velocities, which points to different explosion energies. We have different amounts of nickel, which is different fuel. And we don't know about the progenitors. So here's your standard candle. Okay, that's the theoretical underpinning of your standard candle. It's a little worrisome. Let me not go through this. Okay. So know where you are. This goes back to these different lines in this diagram. So down here, the local sample, everybody talks about the distant supernovae. Okay. The distant supernovae, and there's been a tremendous effort that's gone into this. But remember, you measure a difference. What you truly measure is you measure the difference between this level here and this level out here. That's really what you do. So if you cannot put this down, if your anchor here is sloppy, okay, you introduce an uncertainty on your cosmological measurement. Let me illustrate this. Okay, this is from the Tonnery dataset. Stefan Blondin did that. So this is omega lambda, the likelihood distribution omega lambda, omega matter, in this supernova set, okay? And that's what everybody's been talking about. If you remove all the objects at redshift less than 0.2, okay, all what's usually called the nearby objects, this is your likelihood contour, okay? If you would do this, nobody's going to even talk about this. So this is where Ariel said it's important to have the local sample right, okay? You have to have that local sample right. If as a historical note, Ariel can disagree with me, as a historical note, one of the reasons that the Rees paper was so strong, had the similar result as the Perlmutter paper was, because that sample down here was tied down more strongly in the Rees data set than in the Perlmutter data set. You know, it's a historical quirk. We didn't know this, okay? I know. And this goes back to, let me see, I didn't show this anymore. Yeah, this goes back to those three lines here, okay? Now, if you're uncertain down here where to place your line, okay, that directly goes into your cosmological result, okay? And that's been shown here. This is from Sarab Jha's paper, so that's the canonical point here. But if you only take the supernovae at velocities with higher than 8,000 kilometers, that's how your W measurement shifts, okay? And if you take only the supernovae below 7,000 kilometers, it drops down here, okay? This is dramatic. This is really dramatic. And so, look at the difference here. The differences are tiny within that scatter. So again, Sloan is going to make a big difference.
My point is that you need to know where you are. That's my point. Okay. Now, to fix this problem, there's discussion. There's two papers out there. One by Conley et al. And the other one by Wang et al. It turns out this nearby data sample that I showed you before has a funny color distribution. Nobody thought about this. So you see here the color of these objects as a function of redshift. That means you have a large scatter, or you have reddish objects here. And down here, out here, you have only blue objects. Why that's the case, we don't know.
I'm not.
Okay.
It's selection effect, right? It's mounted bias. Obviously, the near objects you have, you can also take the faint ones, the red ones. So I think.
Yeah, but it's, yeah. I'm scared that the focus bias, you know, this, we're talking redshift function one.
Yeah, but very small numbers, right?
Yeah. Fine. Look, but, you know, if that's the focus bias of the nearby sample, what's the focus bias in this system?
I don't know. The mounted bias has always been a near sample.
Okay. So here we can now to the branding. Okay.
Ariel talked about this, and I'm not going to go through this again, but there are these indications that the reddening law that we assume, the galactic reddening law, is not correct. It should not be applied to the supernovae. Okay. Why that's the case is a big question. We don't know. So if you do a free fit to the distant supernova, you get an RV of 2. That's great because you have to correct your distances with the absorption correction, which if the correction goes color times this term, okay, the magnitude correction. So if you have an uncertainty in the color and you multiply by 3, you realize that your error bars just blow up, okay? And it's great if you can go to a value of 2, then your color uncertainty don't hurt you as much as they did before. Now, we always thought there's no reason to do this. For reasons I don't understand, nobody, I believe, really understands, it seems that RV of 2 seems a better value, and which is great for cosmology because it tightens your constraints. And this Hubble bubble, because of this color distribution here, disappears if you use, instead of RV 3, you use RV of 2, and it disappears. It's pure magic as far as I'm concerned, yes?
If you look at other distance indicators, Kelly Fisher,
yeah,
Dn sigma, fundamental plane, or equivalently if you look at the density of galaxies. There's no evidence whatsoever for a Hubble bubble.
I know.
I would make this case stronger. There is no Hubble bubble, therefore RV is equivalent to.
Yeah, fine. I'm happy. What I'm a little worried about is we're toying with three points. We fall to our fixed parameters and make it a free parameter. I agree with your statement, but it's really, it just makes me nervous. Let me put it out. Okay. And actually, I don't think we have three parameters.
Small technical note, it's actually one, because the beta parameter is RV plus one. So if you transpose RV, it's actually one.
Oh my God.
It's even worse than you think. Yeah.
You got it terrible. I showed this. So this is wrapping it up. So what are we? This is the Hubble diagram some years ago. There's theory. There's essentially various sectors
to work in. So there's the supernova factory, the Carnegie supernova project, and SDSS2. They're working out to redshift 0.3, 0.4. There is ESSENCE and CFHT. As I said, they're going to be finished. These two are going to be finished next year. And then there's the higher C team that's on hold until ACS is going to work again, I guess. And then there's SNAP or something like it. Okay, so you want to go out here. And I should have mentioned here, there are the very local searches like LOTOS, the CFA, and the European Supernova Consortium that are really here to mostly to understand physics. Okay, so what's the next thing? If we take stock, by the end of 2008, so I've been generous, by the end of next year, we have about 1,000 supernovae for cosmology. Okay? We have 500 from SNLS. We have hopefully 200 from ESSENCE. We have 600 from the Sloan. We have over 100 very local ones. So 1,000 is actually a conservative number. We have about 1,000 supernovae for cosmology. I believe a constant W will be determined to 5% at that time. That's how good it's going to be. And we're going to be totally dominated by systematic effects. The reddening, the normalization, the local field, maybe that goes away. And evolution, Mohnquist bias.
That's the ARS in the system.
Yeah. Well, that's right. It will contribute to the system. So, yeah, once you're done with the constant W,
you have to move on to something else. And if you want to go to a variable W, you need to have an accuracy of 2% in each bin, in each redshift bin that you measure. So it's not correct. I shouldn't say individual distances. To each redshift bin that you have. So can we reduce the systematics to this level? And, you know, it's a big question. Of course, statistically, you have to go from 1,000 to 10,000 supernovae. So that's why these are big things now.
When you say we want to test for variable W, you mean once we've shown it's not random?
Yeah.
Before you've shown that, it's irrelevant to test
that's
for W.
Okay. I agree.
I mean, the real question would be, then we have to test for both constant as best as we can.
Right. Well, I mean, okay. So if you want to go from 5 to 1%, you get this. You have to do the same thing. So that's the current status of variable W. I'd like to point out this goes from 7 to minus 8, so you feel nothing. That's just the end of it. And that's my last slide. So we solved the local problem. Maybe it's done, but we need to just get rid of this once for all. The reddening is
going to be something that I just don't know how to handle. I'm just not as optimistic as other people. I think the only way that Ariel is right, we have to just work on this hard enough, and somebody come up with a bright idea. I hope that we can do this. Well, actually, there is one bright idea. You can get rid of this if you go to the infrared. You know, do the whole thing in the infrared, and then you're much better off. Kevin Krishunas has actually shown that in the infrared, in the H-band, K-band, It may be that type 1As are actually standard candles, despite of what I said. They may actually have the same luminosity without correction, which would be fantastic. And you get rid of the reddening problem. So maybe we have to invest in the infrared. I didn't talk about that very much.
Well, with JWST, you can go out to redshift 2, 3, 4. Yeah, but you only get 2 or 3 options. Unless they hand over the telescope to us.
Gotta get it first.
Yeah. So here is one of those selection effects that
may be worrying. Mark Sullivan correlated, these are histograms of the stretch parameter, the light curve shape parameter for star-forming galaxies and passive galaxies, and you see that the 1As seem to have different behaviors in the different galaxies. Again, if the samples become big enough, maybe you just restrict yourself to one of those. Well, here's my thing. You have to understand the 1A physics, I believe. We would really, finally, maybe that's a goal for me before I retire, to know what the Bracheres are. We need to understand these explosion mechanisms, and we have to accept that type 1As are three-dimensional objects. Okay, that's something that we it's been great. I said recently in a different context, I'm born 100 years too late because I love one-dimensional spherical symmetric things, but we have to accept that they're three dimensions. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.
So, short question. Besides of cosmology, so fundamentalist problem, this determination of this parameter of dark energy, all these observations of high-energy supernova, what they are useful for else? Evolutionary effect or what?
Yes. So, let me show you. We have this. Was this slide here. So we learned a lot about the supernovae themselves. So we have with the spectroscopy here, for example, it's a bit difficult right now, but this paper here, the Broadman paper and Broadman paper, both papers that tried to look at differences, evolution of type 1As, that's actually very useful. There's other things that you could do which we haven't done at all. I think an important problem to address, which is kind of in the data, but nobody's done that, is to look for corpuscular supernovae and then do an average star formation rate over redshift. That's something that actually would be a great project to do, and nobody's doing. I know one person has tried it, but it's. So the data sets are out there. One thing that a student of mine is doing is I'm looking for AGNs, for example. That have different cut at the AGN luminosity function by selecting variable AGNs through the variability rather than other parameters.
And don't forget that the imaging used for such surveys is useful for other science.
I should have said that. Yes. I mean, the SNLS. The CFHT legacy survey is a weak lensing survey. They're doing galaxy lensing, they're doing supernova stuff, they're doing solar system objects, so there's a large collection.
Yeah, just a comment, maybe I had too many happy posts this morning about it belonging in North America. but I mean, actually, this precisely showed that you can definitely rule out that age not below 50, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the most important couples in science,
it's
right?
Not. I wish that we would have better models to actually try to understand. I'm glad you look at it that way.
I realize in that respect it's really a standard candle, right? I mean, you can definitely pull out the latest problems with all things. And I would be very optimistic. I don't know why everybody's so sad.
Well, in at least in astrophysical circles, the Hubble constant, you have to now quote 10% of the Hubble constant, otherwise you're not in the game.
I give you one more optimistic, actually, conclusion of your talk. Mm-hmm. The point is, what we're going to need to guess is that we have to go further further redshift.
Yes.
Higher redshift. Yes. But it's actually not true. From you and Ariel's talk, we learn it's actually the intermediate range, which will be very conclusive with respect to if it's a constant or something else. So that's good news as well, right?
I'm always painting a rather gloomy picture, and I should apologize for that. we've gone a long way. I mean, it's, when it comes to acceleration, the supernovae are the only game in time right now. There's anything on the horizon, which is beautiful, but this is the only thing that we have to lose at the moment.
And then up to this new other things. Tomorrow morning we'll start